The Katra Podcast, conversations for the curious, essential knowledge, simplified. Your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of eKatra AI. Welcome to this deep dive. Today we're focusing on, well, a concept that really underpins all global politics, yet one we rarely examine critically. Peace itself.
That's right. And we're exploring the really transformative work of Professor Oliver P. Richmond. He spent decades looking at how the world tries to build peace and why fundamentally those efforts often seem to keep failing.
Yeah, it's quite striking when you look at it that way. When we read Richmond's extensive works, especially Peace, A History, and his very short introduction, you really start to realize something. You see that our global approach to resolving conflict is often, well, deeply flawed.
Definitely. We're talking about why, you know, despite investing billions of dollars, these vast international missions, countless signed treaties, why do post-conflict societies so often just collapse back into instability?
It's a huge question. And Richmond's mission, as you said, is to shine a very bright, critical light on the dominant global strategy, the one he actually labels the liberal peace.
And this frames the central tension, the core idea that Richmond puts forward for you, the listener, to consider. Is peace just about stopping the fighting? You know, the absence of war and major violence. That's what scholars call negative peace.
Right, just stopping the bad stuff.
Exactly. Or is peace something much more ambitious, like the sustained presence of social justice, equity, human rights, actual well-being? That's positive peace.
And Richmond's argument is?
He argues the international community tends to prioritize the negative, the just stopping the violence part.
Yeah.
And because of that, we systematically fail to achieve the positive, the deeper stuff.
Hmm. So let's unpack the messenger a bit before we dive deeper into the message itself. Professor Oliver P. Richmond.
Yeah, he's a truly leading figure, highly influential in international relations. He actually founded an entire academic approach called Critical Peace Studies. He's currently a research professor at the University of Manchester.
And what makes his perspective so distinctive, right, is that he's not just some detached academic sort of crunching numbers in an office.
Not at all. His credentials, they're built on over two decades of scholarly work, yes, but combined with extensive hands-on fieldwork. We're talking about complex, conflict-affected regions like Cyprus, the Balkans, Afghanistan, places he's actually been and worked.
So this is, in theory, developed in an ivory tower somewhere. It's really a critique forged in the field from direct experience. And while most mainstream academics were maybe asking, okay, how do we make this liberal peace thing work better? Richmond was instrumental in asking a much more radical question.
Right. He was asking, hold on, is the liberal peace itself the problem? Whose interests are really being served by this massive global peace-building industry?
That's a powerful question.
It is. He was like one of the first to really step completely outside that dominant framework, to question the power dynamics, you know, the ones that define what successful peace even means. He insists we have to look at the historical baggage, sometimes even the colonial baggage, that the current model carries.
Okay, so let's get into the core premise of his work then. Looking at his combined writings, Richmond argues that this global political project, the liberal peace, is inherently flawed. Why?
Because it tries to apply a specific Western top-down political template.
Yeah.
It's centered on these three big ideas: rapid democratization, market economies, and the rule of law.
Right. And here's where the critique really gets its teeth, doesn't it? He says this model functions like rigid social engineering.
Exactly. It's like a single one-size-fits-all blueprint for every single society emerging from conflict. And it completely ignores the specific historical context, the local traditions, or even the particular trauma that community has experienced.
It reminds me of that analogy, like trying to design a custom suit for everyone in the world, but only using one pattern.
Yeah.
A pattern designed by a tailor who lives thousands of miles away. I mean, it might look structurally correct to the expert who designed it, but
it almost certainly doesn't fit the person who actually has to wear it every day.
Right. And this process, he argues, it disempowers local communities. It pushes aside their own solutions.
And the consequence of this imposition, well, it's kind of shocking. He talks about the creation of what he chillingly calls virtual or phantom states.
Phantom states. What does that mean exactly?
It means you get institutions like parliaments, courts, ministries that look functional on paper. They pick the boxes for international donors, but they lack any deep roots or genuine legitimacy among the actual population. They're just facades, perpetually dependent on foreign aid and intervention.
Wow. Okay, so if the solution isn't this top-down imposition, What's the alternative vision he offers?
Well, Richmond strongly advocates for what's known as the local turn.
A local turn, okay.
Yeah, the idea here is that sustainable peace, real peace, it's an emergent process. It's dynamic. It's not something delivered on a plane by foreign diplomats. You know, it has to be negotiated and constructed from the ground up.
So found in the actions and choices of the people actually living through the conflict.
Precisely. It's a really radical call for international actors, the big organizations, to adopt a posture of humility. Of learning and supporting, rather than dictating and designing everything.
Let's deepen this by looking back a bit at history. Richmond traces this genealogy of peace, showing the concept had almost always been defined by whoever held power at the time.
Right, like the Pax Romana, the Roman peace.
Yeah, that lasted for centuries, but it was fundamentally an imposed order, wasn't it? Maintained by military might.
Totally. It was designed to ensure, you know, smooth trade and tax collection for the Roman Empire, not necessarily justice or well-being for the people they conquered.
And that idea of imposed structural peace sort of carries forward, doesn't it? Even into modern political philosophy.
Mm. Yeah. Richmond traces a direct link to Immanuel Kant's idea back in the 18th century of perpetual peace. Kant basically tied lasting global peace to the internal character of states. Specifically, he thought peace would naturally emerge among republican, or what we now call liberal, societies.
Okay, so that philosophical seed eventually grew into the modern post-Cold War framework we've been talking about, the liberal peace tripod.
Exactly. And it got institutionalized by major global bodies, the UN, the World Bank, and so on. This system created that vast peace industrial complex of agencies, consultants, NGOs we see everywhere today.
And that tripod stands on three legs, right? Three core components they try to implement all at once.
That's the idea. First, democratization, which usually just means holding rapid multi-party elections.
Okay.
Second, market liberalization. So opening up economies to free markets, global integration, that kind of thing.
Right.
And third, establishing the rule of law and promoting human rights, but usually defined in a very Western way.
Okay, so let's look at the practical critique. Why does this system often backfire in practice?
Well, if you look at case studies like Bosnia or Kosovo, or even early interventions in Afghanistan, you see massive resources were spent trying to install this exact template.
But often, holding those rapid elections, the democratization part, it didn't unify the nation, did it?
No, quite the opposite sometimes. It often actually cemented the pre-existing ethnic or political divisions by formalizing political representation along those very fault lines. It hardened them.
And what about the market liberalization element? That sounds potentially risky too.
It really can be. Richmond highlights how rapid privatization and integration into the global economy can dramatically worsen existing inequalities. Think about it. If external actors come in and swiftly privatize key national assets, who usually benefits?
Probably a small, already powerful elite group.
Exactly. A small, politically connected elite. This creates new economic winners and losers almost overnight, generating fresh resentment and potentially fueling new underlying conflicts, even if the open fighting is technically stopped.
So there's that unnerving idea of the phantom state again. The big international bodies spending billions building institutions that look good on spreadsheets.
But fail to address the core injustices that might have caused the conflict in the first place.
Which leads us then to the constructive alternative, what Richmond calls the post-liberal shift.
Right. This is the move toward what he terms emancipatory peace.
Emancipatory. Okay, what does that mean?
So if the liberal peace is mainly about structural stability, often in ways that benefit the global system, emancipatory peace is fundamentally about freedom. The goal isn't just stability, it's liberating people from domination, political, economic, social, so they can genuinely shape their own futures.
And how do you achieve that?
It involves integrating peace efforts with existing local norms and practices, rather than just imposing external blueprints from the outside.
Okay, but this sounds, well, it sounds slow. If there's an immediate deadly humanitarian crisis unfolding, don't we sometimes need some kind of rapid top-down intervention, even if it's imperfect, just to establish basic security?
That's the fundamental dilemma, isn't it? And Richmond absolutely recognizes it's a messy, complex process. There are no easy answers. That's why he introduces this crucial idea of hybridity as reality.
Hybridity, meaning?
Meaning the reality on the ground is never purely liberal peace. Nor is it purely local peace. It's always a blend, a hybrid. You might see international concepts like human rights language being used by a local NGO, mixed right alongside local customary practices, like, say, traditional councils of elders resolving land disputes.
Ah, okay. So the failure isn't that hybridity exists. It's trying to force it to be purely Western.
Exactly. The solution, he argues, lies in engaging constructively with the messy hybridity that already exists on the ground, rather than trying to erase the local part.
This brings us to what feels like the real key concept, maybe the most powerful takeaway from his work, everyday peace.
Absolutely. If emancipatory peace is the ultimate goal, the, you know, structural freedom, then everyday peace is the method. It's the resilient relational building block.
So peace isn't just found in a treaty signed in Geneva.
No, not primarily. It's found in the ordinary interactions of daily life. It's there in the shared marketplace where people from opposing groups still conduct business together. It's in the cross-community friendships that somehow endure through conflict.
The informal negotiations over water rights, maybe?
Yes, or quiet acts of resilience against domination. These small daily decisions, these mundane interactions, these are the true resilient foundations of peace. And they're often completely invisible to international missions because those missions are typically looking for formal structures like governments and courts.
That's a really powerful reframing of agency, isn't it? It suggests the people living there aren't just passive recipients of aid or victims of conflict. They are the primary architects of any lasting stability.
Precisely.
Okay, zooming out a bit, this leads us to some really crucial themes that run through his work. The first one feels huge. The idea that the very definition of peace is an instrument of power.
Yeah, if you connect this to the bigger picture, it becomes really clear. By imposing the liberal model, external actors are essentially projecting their own values. And this creates a dynamic of external control that, Richman argues, sometimes echoes colonial era attitudes.
So we always need to ask, whose interests are truly being served when a specific version of peace, maybe one that quickly opens markets and holds elections, is declared successful?
Exactly. Whose success is it?
And that success, that externally defined success, often comes at the expense of genuine local ownership, which links directly to the second theme, right? The failure of top-down state building.
Yes. The relentless focus on formal institutions without deep social roots leads directly back to those hollow states or phantom states we talked about.
Because real legitimacy, it has to be grown organically. It has to be earned through local participation, local trust. It can't just be designed in Washington or Brussels and imported wholesale.
Which highlights theme three, the primacy of local knowledge. Richman argues quite strongly that every society possesses really sophisticated embedded knowledge about how to manage conflict. They have customary laws, community governance structures that have often worked for generations.
But this knowledge is often dismissed, isn't it? Labeled as traditional or informal or even primitive by external experts.
Exactly. Dismissed by experts who privilege their own, often imported institutional models. It's a kind of dismissal of local genius.
Okay, but let me play devil's advocate for a second. What if some of that local customary law or traditional governance is actually, you know, exclusionary or oppressive, particularly towards women or marginalized groups? How does the international community support local peace without inadvertently validating local injustice?
That's a critical question and a really important one. Richman doesn't argue for just blindly accepting all local norms. Not at all. He argues for engagement and integration. The solution isn't just imposition from outside, nor is it complete hands-off acceptance. It lies more in encouraging and supporting local processes that allow communities themselves to contest and reform their own traditions internally.
Ah, so it shifts the role of the international actor, not imposing standards directly, but maybe facilitating internal dialogue and change, supporting local reformers.
Precisely. It's about empowering internal transformation rather than external dictation, which often creates backlash anyway.
Okay. And that leads to the final theme, peace as a dynamic process.
Yes. We really need to stop viewing peace as some kind of static endpoint, like the moment a treaty is signed, peace is achieved. It doesn't work like that.
It's more like a continuous journey.
It's exactly. An evolving process of negotiation, contestation, adaptation, even struggle. The goal isn't necessarily to eliminate conflict entirely. That's probably impossible. It's more about building the social capacity, the resilience within a society, to handle future disputes justly and crucially without resorting to widespread violence.
Richman's writing, it really does contain some powerful, memorable insights that stick with you. They sort of redefine the whole field. Let's maybe touch on a few key quotes or ideas.
Yeah, definitely. That critique of the system is so sharp. I remember him saying something like, the liberal peace has promised much but delivered little.
Creating virtual states and virtual peace that exists more in the imagination of international bureaucrats than in the lived experiences of affected populations. That really highlights the disconnect.
Absolutely. And his call for what you could call epistemic justice, valuing local knowledge, is captured when he says something like, every society possesses sophisticated knowledge about managing conflict.
But this knowledge is often dismissed as traditional, primitive, or informal by external actors who privilege their own institutional models. It's about being blind to local genius.
Yeah, exactly.
And for me, the essence of the alternative, the solution, lies in his focus on the small scale, the idea that everyday peace emerges from the ordinary interactions through which people navigate difference, manage disagreement, and maintain relationships across lines of division.
Mm. It shifts your attention, doesn't it? Away from the presidential palaces and the grand ceremonies.
And directs it right towards shared neighborhoods, marketplaces, everyday life.
These ideas, they have really serious real-life applications, don't they? They extend far beyond academic circles or the halls of the UN.
Definitely. For us, just as global citizens consuming news, it demands much more critical media consumption. So when we hear a news report saying, oh, democratic elections were successfully held in country X, we need to pause and ask deeper questions informed by this kind of critique.
Like, did that process actually exacerbate ethnic tensions? Was that election really designed for the international community's checklist? Or did it genuinely increase legitimacy for the people living there?
Right. And for practitioners, people working in NGOs, diplomatic staff, policymakers.
For them, it requires, I think, radical humility, a real shift in mindset, moving away from being the architect of a new society towards being more of a facilitator and supporter of processes that are already happening locally.
Which probably means changing funding priorities too, right?
Absolutely. It means maybe funding and protecting those local peace committees, the local women's groups, the actual engines of everyday peace, rather than pouring, you know, all the resources solely into the big, formal, often imported state institutions.
And you know, you can even apply this concept of everyday peace right in your own community, can't you?
You really can. It demands that we recognize the immense value in those small acts of bridge building right where we live. Committing to genuine dialogue, even when it's uncomfortable, with people we fundamentally disagree with. Supporting the vital work of local community organizers.
It brings it home. Peace ultimately is about the health and justice of our own social fabric, too, not just something that happens in far-off wars.
It takes peace building out of the realm of just high politics and foreign policy and brings it right back to our homes, our neighborhoods.
Yeah, making us accountable in a way for the peace we choose to build or fail to build right where we are.
So thinking about final takeaways, for me, it's really that profound paradigm shift Richmond demands. Peace isn't some external commodity that can be imposed or delivered like a package. It's something organic that has to emerge from within communities.
Yeah.
Yes, supported by structural reforms, absolutely. But built fundamentally on the foundation of relationships and local resilience.
And what surprised me most, I think, was grappling with that idea of the phantom state, that chilling image of a facade of institutions without any real social foundation. The lasting insight for me is that true, sustainable peace requires us, especially those from the outside, to genuinely recognize the agency, the capacity, the wisdom of the people actually living through the conflict.
Mm-hmm.
We have to adopt a policy, a posture of listening and supporting before we jump in to dictate and design. Listen first.
Well said.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.